From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, as COVID cases mount once again, hope on the horizon.
Millions of doses are going to go out before the end of this year. Everyone is getting ready to deliver this vaccine as quickly as possible.
But is it soon enough for healthcare workers who are struggling to keep up?
I'm worried about nurses getting each other sick.
And what happens to indigenous people when the earth warms and the land on which they've lived for generations melts?
The ice is breaking and they fall right through with their machinery or with their dogs and into the ocean.
All ahead on Perspective. Some big developments on the coronavirus front this week. Infections are way up, but a vaccine, we're told, is on its way. However, it's not here yet.
We are in a humanitarian crisis with this pandemic.
Dr. John Brownstein, an epidemiologist and ABC News medical contributor, as cases continue to surge across the country, so do hospitalizations and deaths. In a 24-hour period this week, 2,879 people died of COVID-19. That is the most recorded on a single day throughout the pandemic. And we haven't even hit the expected surge following the Thanksgiving holiday.
We saw Operation Warp Speed. Well, we need Operation Warp Speed for masking, Operation Warp Speed for testing. The CDC needs to engage here to get people to understand that they need to stay at home, cancel all non-essential gatherings, and get through these next few months.
The toll is clearly being felt on healthcare workers and so many of us. For now, let's simply say that wherever you are in the country, there's a good chance you may be feeling the same stress, worry, anxiety, and fear as you did during the pandemic's earliest days. But there is a vaccine, three of them actually, the one created by Pfizer, given the green light by British regulators this week. ABC's Maggie Rooley was in London when the announcement was made.
The UK is now the first country in the world to approve the Pfizer vaccine. It says they're going to start rolling it out in just a matter of days. Now, in this first round, about 400,000 people are going to get the vaccine. It was going to go to the people that need it the most, to people living in care homes as well as their caregivers. We're told that millions of doses are going to go out before the end of this year. Hospitals are standing by. Vaccination centers are getting set up. This is the fastest a vaccine has ever gone from concept to reality. And scientists stress, though, that despite that speed, no corners have been cut. The health secretary even offered to take the vaccine live on British television just to prove it. He then went on to say something that I think we have all been waiting to hear. He said, "This is the light at the end of the tunnel." He's confident that by next summer, it could be one that everyone could enjoy.
So, yay, Britain. They'll get the first doses of the most studied vaccine on the planet. Not to make it all about us, but what about us? Dr. Monsef Slaoui is the chief science officer for Operation Warp Speed, the project designed to develop these vaccines in record time. He talked about that with us this week.
It's great news, I think, that an independent regulatory body that outside of the U.S., outside of the context in which these vaccines have been developed, has come to a positive decision regarding the Pfizer vaccine. I would expect the FDA to reach a similar conclusion. But of course, as you know, the operation is totally separated from the FDA as far as judgments are concerned, and things will follow their course. But I hope by the 10th or the 11th of December, Pfizer vaccine is approved.
Dr. Thomas Frieden is the former head of the CDC. He and numerous other public health officials are vouching for the safety of these shots, but he also knows that some are skeptical, which is one of the many reasons transparency, he says, must be key.
We do expect approval to come pretty soon, but I would also expect there to be bumps in the road in the vaccination program. When you vaccinate millions of people, some people get really sick after the vaccination, and you don't know whether that was the vaccine or that was just coincidence. So that has to be studied carefully, or you're going to get all sorts of wild rumors flying around. That's another place where you really need transparency. There may be production problems, there may be rumors, there may be people who don't want to take it, even if you do have the vaccine. So this is probably the single most complicated vaccination program in American history.
This past week, our own chief medical correspondent, Dr. Jennifer Ashton, was supposed to hold an Instagram Live event with the head of the FDA on the rollout of the COVID vaccine. but the FDA had technical difficulties and couldn't join. So ABC News, not wanting to squander the time, had Dr. Jen take questions from her thousands of Instagram followers. And those questions were really good, some just as good as the ones we would have asked here. For example,
if you have had COVID-19, should you be vaccinated? So I've asked both Dr. Anthony Fauci and Dr. Stephen Hahn that question. If or when, really when these vaccines get FDA emergency use authorization or full FDA approval down the road, they go by the patient population of the clinical trials. So for example, if pregnant women were not studied, then pregnant women are an off-label indication or not indicated to get this vaccine. The initial phase 3 clinical trials, people were excluded from participation if they were known to have had COVID-19.
Here's another one.
Will this vaccine have to be taken every year like the flu, or will it be a one and done? Short answer is they don't know. Let's talk about what we do know about SARS-CoV-2. This is an RNA vaccine. This is an RNA virus, and RNA viruses mutate for a living. However, as they've been looking at the genetic fingerprint of this virus since last December, January, when it was first identified, it really appears that it is mutating very, very slowly. That's a good thing for the vaccine. Also remember that coronavirus causes 10 to 30% of common colds experienced worldwide. And as we all know, you can get a cold one year and then get another cold either the same year or a couple of years later. Do people think it is possible to need other doses of this vaccine as we do with, let's say, influenza down the road? Yes, but remember right now, we just don't have that time study period yet, so it's unknown.
Finally,
when someone refuses to take the vaccination, then what? We haven't heard anything about this yet. I can tell you, as a practicing physician that goes through an informed consent process with my patients, generally for surgery, but sometimes for certain types of tests or treatment, there's a very important ethical principle called autonomy. My job is to educate patient as to the pros, the cons, the risks, the benefits, options, and alternatives. It's the patient's job to make a decision. And that principle of patient autonomy is at the backbone of our medical system. It's really a legal question and a government question as to whether or not there will be legislation about this. In my professional and medical opinion as a practicing physician, I will always respect a patient's decision, even if it is to decline or refuse treatment or decline or refuse a certain test, as long as they have been appropriately educated as to pros and cons, risks versus benefits.
We're very lucky to have Dr. Jen here. She's not only our chief medical correspondent, she's also a practicing OBGYN, and she knows firsthand how hard this has been for so many doctors and nurses. A recent survey of 1,000 frontline healthcare workers found more than 90% of them are experiencing stress directly related to COVID-19. Not only is that a concern right now, it raises a lot of questions about the future of those going into the profession. ABC's Jim Ryan reports.
Her pain is palpable as an El Paso ICU nurse who asked not to be identified describes seeing terminally ill COVID patients FaceTime with their families.
It's just really heartbreaking to have to watch that because you feel completely helpless. There's nothing you can say that is going to make it better.
The nonprofit Mental Health America has tried to objectively quantify the emotions that nurse and her colleagues are feeling.
We did a survey and reached more than 1,000 healthcare workers.
MHA President Paul Gianfrido.
93% of them reported to us that they were experiencing stress, and 82% were experiencing emotional exhaustion, a much greater percentage than the number who were even feeling physical exhaustion.
Along with the exhaustion, says UC Davis Medical Center nurse Melissa Johnson Camacho.
There's just this overall tension in the hospital. It's hard.
And then there's the fear that you or a colleague might contract coronavirus.
I'm worried about nurses getting each other sick and not having enough nurses for all these patients that are coming in.
Stress, exhaustion, fear, and then frustration. A As a party rages at a home in Nashville, no masks, no distancing, doctors and nurses in a nearby hospital struggle to save the lives of COVID patients.
We keep calling them our frontline heroes, but we don't treat them that way, do we?
Paul Gianfrido says frustration and anger set in when doctors and nurses see people refusing to take simple precautions against coronavirus infections.
You know, we're not doing the one thing that we can do that would most take care of our frontline healthcare workers, and that's do what we can to stay healthy.
He says the lasting impact of COVID-19 might be an exodus of healthcare workers from the profession.
Some people have told us in our survey that they've certainly had second thoughts about whether or not this is the right profession for them and whether or not they're going to stay in the profession. We may see healthcare employers, healthcare institutions, having to change dramatically the kinds of mental health supports and emotional health supports they give to workers.
Back in El Paso, where 1,100 people have died of COVID-19, a nurse puts on her scrubs and heads back to the hospital.
I dread sometimes going into work because I just know, like, it might not be a good day. You know, depending on the day, one person might code, 10 people might code. It's a very stressful situation.
Reporting for Perspective, Jim Ryan, ABC News.
This week, one of the top election officials in the state of Georgia, Gabriel Sterling, spoke up about the rhetoric surrounding the election and threats of violence that have resulted.
It has all gone too far.
He specifically called on President Trump to rein in supporters.
Mr. President, you have not condemned these actions or this language. Senators, you have not condemned this language or these actions. This has to stop. We need you to step up, and if you're going to take a position of leadership, show some.
The president's continued to claim voter fraud in the election despite continued losses in court, and he's targeted Georgia on Twitter. Sterling oversaw the new voting system in the state and was visibly angry while providing an update on the state's second recount.
There are some nutballs out there who are going to take this and say, the president told me to do this. Essentially, you have to be responsible.
Runoff elections are held in Georgia when no candidate wins the required majority of votes, and that's what happened this year. So on January 5th, Democratic candidates Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff are looking to unseat Republican incumbents Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, with control of the Senate as the prize if either party wins both races. Now, this has made the state a magnet for political volunteers and for fundraising. To talk more about what they're doing and how much this means to both sides, we talked about the races with ABC News Deputy Political Director Mary Ellis Parks.
What do you foresee happening over the next month?
I think it's going to be really close, and we're all going to be focused on this race. You know, if you're Republicans, these races signify an important check on Joe Biden's administration. And if you're Democrats, it's hard to imagine Joe Biden being able to make significant progress on nearly anything without winning these two seats. Joe Biden likes to pitch himself as a consensus builder who can work across the aisle, but it is a whole lot easier to get votes passed through Congress if you control the majority in both chambers.
So what are we going to look at? I mean, is it pouring unprecedented amounts of money into this Georgia race?
These are candidates that can raise just record amounts of money. We've seen some Democrats on the ground actually pretty worried that there might be a flood of volunteers and supporters and outside interests in the state. Democrats tend to do well in Georgia when the race is about local issues. I think that it does pose a potential risk for Democrats if this starts to become an issue about national Democratic sort of big ticket items. I think that that sort of national attention could backfire for Democrats. But I think a lot of what we're going to be looking at is how exactly Joe Biden was able to win in the state and whether or not the two Democrats can now replicate his success. You know, in some ways, the two candidates almost represent, sort of in simple terms, the coalition that propelled Joe Biden to take the state. You have Reverend Warnock, who in some ways represents just the strength and power of the Black vote in Georgia, unbelievable organizing power in the Black church, and a real engagement, again, with young Black voters on a lot of these key issues around racial equity and police violence. And then you have John Ossoff, who ran his first race. He lost, but he ran for the House in the Georgia suburbs and was able to kind of speak to women, suburbanites, who are frustrated with the current Republican Party. And so if John Ossoff and Warnock can sort of play to those strengths balance each other's weaknesses, they might be able to replicate the success that Joe Biden had. That said, a month ago, Joe Biden did a lot better in the state than those two Democrats on their own. So it really remains to be seen if they can do what he did.
What did you think of what happened with one of when the top election official came out and really railed against what he's seen when it came to Republicans and the vote counting and calling them out this week?
Yeah, he was really emotional. And look, he's saying, we're the ones that actually have the information. We're the ones that are doing the work of elections, and that the rhetoric has just gotten so explosive, so threatening, so scary that, I mean, like you said, he said that it's really just crossed the line. Republicans are in a really tricky spot right now where the president's rhetoric could backfire for them horribly. There was a big conversation early on when we saw so many Senate Republicans unwilling to publicly call Joe Biden the president-elect. And a lot of the whispering in Washington was, look, they're worried about Georgia. They need the president to show up and campaign for them in Georgia. If they're going to win those two seats, which they desperately need, they need the president's help. And now that's looking totally backwards and looking like they might have sort of been placing their chips in the wrong basket, because now you have the president and his team still a month in saying that Georgia voters should maybe not trust elections and suggest that elections themselves are rigged. And we saw some of the president's own supporters even float this idea of boycotting the Georgia elections.
Switching gears a little bit, going to Washington, pardons at the White House as President Trump leaves. Thoughts on what we might see and how many of them and what kinds of pardons?
I think we should be prepared to see many pardons. I think that the president has enjoyed this power of his. We've seen him like sort of the absolute nature of being able to grant someone a pardon. I don't think that he feels sort of worried about any of the political blowback from doing it. I think that there's real talk of even granting pardons to members of his own family. Members of his own family have been thought to be the potential suspect of charges and cases as soon as the president leaves office, whether it's how some of the Trump charities were won or how money was raised for his inauguration, and then some of the own sort of inner workings of the Trump business. The family could fall square in the middle of court cases. And I think that that is exactly the fear that the president has, that those close to him have. And so he might be willing to grant a pardon. But of course, it's really politically risky to grant a pardon, to write a pardon. A pardon by itself is an admission of guilt. It's an acceptance of guilt. You're saying you are pardoning someone for something they have done wrong. Of course, if the Trump family doesn't think that they've really done anything wrong, or they would think that future potential criminal charges would be unfair, overblown, then you have to kind of pretzel logic your way into why a pardon would be necessary. So, you know, it adds some pressure to the president to get this right.
ABC Deputy Political Director Mary Alice Parks, as Arizona and Wisconsin certify their election results this week, becoming the last two of the big battleground states to do so. With another 712,000 Americans filing for unemployment benefits last week, one of the things President-elect Joe Biden will have to tackle right away when he takes office in a little over 6 weeks is the battered U.S. economy. He's now announced he'll be heading up the team working on that. Here's ABC News Chief Congressional Correspondent Mary Bruce.
President-elect Joe Biden speaking directly to suffering Americans.
Our message to everybody struggling right now is this: help is on the way.
Introducing the team that he says will rebuild the economy. Former Fed Chair Janet Yellen, his pick for Treasury Secretary.
It's essential that we move with urgency.
The scope of the economic crisis is massive. More than 50 million Americans could go hungry this year. Nearly 7 million are at risk of eviction. And more than 20 million are now on unemployment. One of them, 60-year-old Diana Adelmo of San Antonio, Texas, who was laid off.
I feel just scared that things, I want to stay positive and think, oh, maybe, you know, something will come, but I don't know at this point.
Biden imploring Congress to act now.
The full Congress should come together and pass a robust package for relief.
ABC's Mary Bruce in Washington, where Senate Republicans and Democrats appear to be moving closer to a $908 billion bipartisan pandemic relief bill.
Coming up, as the world breaks more weather records, we'll talk to one person whose community depends on reversing the effects of climate change. It's a matter of life and death. On Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, a demand for more diversity at some of America's top companies. But first, the world has obliterated weather records in 2020. According to the UN Weather Agency, it was one of the most extreme years ever for hurricanes, wildfires, heat waves, floods, droughts, and ice melt. President-elect Biden recently named John Kerry as his climate envoy as he looks to address an issue that voters told us during the election was on their minds.
A top three issue when I'm talking to voters is climate change. Even right now, despite everything going on, it's climate change.
Really?
For people living in other parts of the world, like around or close to the Arctic, the weather hasn't just been an inconvenience, though. It's been a matter of life and death, as highlighted in the new documentary, The Last Ice, produced by our partners at National Geographic. Mitali Okalik has built awareness around the ways climate change affects her Inuit community in the northern part of the world. It's something I talk with her about ahead of the film's release. Explain to our listeners, for those who may not know, what area of the world are we talking about? How many miles is it? How big is it? And how many people are there?
So Inuit, we occupy Inuit Nunat, our homeland, and it stretches across four nation states in the Arctic. So from Russia to the U.S., across Canada and up and over to Greenland. And so we cover the top of the world, and we are over a large area of water, land, and ice, but we are a small population of about 170,000 people.
How long have people lived there?
Since the beginning of time, for thousands and thousands of years. And we intend to continue to live here in our homeland.
Tell me what life is like there right now.
Right now, I'm doing my, grad school in Nuuk, Greenland, even though I'm from Canada. It's just the most wonderful place to be, so peaceful. We have a very good balance of tradition in terms of our culture and our language and our way of life, but also modern ways as well.
Tell me more about the culture and the way of life there. What is it like?
Well, we're a hunting people, so we're completely dependent on our land, the water in our environment. And so we are very much dependent on the food sources that we harvest, which we have for thousands of years. And some things that we consume include whale, caribou, fish, seal, and these are all staples in our food source. So it's our food security. The cost of living is really, really high because all of the places that we live are mostly accessible by air only. And so we import food, which is very expensive. And so we have to supplement our main food source, which is the food that we hunt, with the store-bought food that is really costly.
It sounds like, it doesn't sound like it is, people stretched across a very, very vast area. How big are the villages typically with the number of people who are there?
Well, it varies. So we have cities like Nuuk, where I'm living right now as a student, is the capital of Greenland, and there are about 19,000 people who live here. And that's like a huge city in Inuit Nunat. And then some of the smaller communities could be from 30 or so people So it varies in terms of size.
The name of the National Geographic documentary is The Last Ice, and it chronicles what the people there are fighting against with climate change. Describe for us what it's like now and what it was, you know, maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and how things are changing and how quickly they're changing.
The Last Ice is really a great film, feature-length documentary that helps tell that story. Because as you can hear in the film, Alekhatsiak Perry, who is a hunter from the northern part of Greenland, indicates that the ability to access traditional knowledge and ways of being in terms of hunting has changed substantially in his lifetime alone. And he is a relatively young man, because it's that quick that climate change is affecting our environment. And so he indicates that there are areas that we were able to hunt before that we can no longer access due to the breakdown of the sea ice. Whenever we were making the film, we traveled to different areas of our homeland, and we heard different ways in which climate change has affected people on a day-to-day basis today. And so there are communities that have had to evacuate because of the melting permafrost underneath the land where the homes are built that's melting. And so they've had to evacuate and change, uproot their entire lives and adapt to a new life in a new place. And then in other places, we're losing our hunters through the sea ice because it's just changing so quickly and it is not the same anymore. So it affects, you know, families, and it affects food security, because those hunters would be the ones that would be putting the food on the table.
Have you seen it change personally, just, you know, with your own eyes?
Yes, because I've attended funerals of hunters who have died because of the changing sea ice. Our sea ice is our highway. And so in order to be able to access the different animals that we harvest and their migration routes and patterns, you have to travel quite far from where we have our communities today. When the sea ice is melting and it's much more unpredictable, there are circumstances whereby if you're traveling by a skidoo, which is like a snowmobile, or a dog team, which you see in the film The Last Ice, there are areas that are no longer strong enough to sustain our people. And so what happens is they're falling through, the ice is breaking, and they fall right through with their machinery or with their dogs and into the ocean. And so there have been cases where hunters have been able to successfully come back up and onto the ice and become saved, and they lose their equipment and so on. And then our community members really rally together to fundraise so that that hunter can get those things back and continue hunting. But there are many instances where, unfortunately, they are unable to resurface. And so we've had to have funerals without bodies. And we really are the human face of climate change in this world.
Do you see it changing in the future?
We could be doing more. And one of the solutions put forward in The Last Ice is the seeing through the Pikkelisoswak, which is the North Water Polynya, and conserving that area so that we could be proactive players in ensuring that an area is protected to prevent further degradation of the sea ice as with other like incoming traffic from outsiders. And the other thing is, I think that it will only get worse when there is more traffic for shipping or more resource development. It is really problematic for us because we don't want to end up in the, you know, in the back and crying for help. Why not be proactive? And the film really identifies a really solid solution moving forward.
Well, the film is called The Last Ice. It's from National Geographic Pristine Seas and Mitali Okalik. I want to thank you very much. This is a really fascinating topic, and I think it's something that a lot of people should see and will want to see because it's beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you as well. I really appreciated this conversation.
Nonprofits that typically benefit from a year-end push are facing a real challenge this year. More Americans are in need of assistance, but traditional means of collecting donations are being interrupted. ABC News producer Stephanie Pawlowski has the story of one popular organization looking to continue its charity fundraising in a new way this holiday season.
It's a sound that's oh so familiar to the holiday season. The iconic Salvation Army bell ringer, standing outside stores with a red kettle collecting donations for local campaigns. But with so much change this year because of the pandemic, will the Salvation Army even have bell ringers this year?
The Salvation Army is going to be ringing bells in every location that is available to us between now and Christmas.
Kenneth Hodder is the national commander of the Salvation Army. He says with the decline in the number of retail spots, a national coin shortage, and less foot traffic, the Salvation Army's traditional fundraising is at risk.
In a normal year, our Christmas Kettle campaign would raise about $126 million. Our current projection is that we will see a 50% decline in that figure. So we're trying to find ways by which we can find the missing $60 million.
In addition, Commissioner Hodder says even more people are in need of assistance this year for things like rent, food, and utilities.
We currently project that there will be 155% more people coming to the Salvation Army for Christmas assistance this year.
So how does the organization cope with a 50% decline in donations, a 155% increase in need, and fewer places to donate? Going online, of course.
RescueChristmas.org is the heart and soul of what we're trying to do this year. And primarily that's because that location, which will be tailored to their own zip code, will give them information not only on what the Salvation Army is doing there, but will give them the opportunity to apply for assistance if they need help from the Salvation Army this year. It's going to be a one-stop shop.
Commissioner Hodder says donors can also drop a digital donation at a Red Kettle site. They can text Kettle to 91999 to make a donation, or they can donate via Amazon Alexa. But the Salvation Army isn't alone this year. Deputy Vice President of the Marine Toys for Tots Foundation, Kelly Hardison, says not as many retailers want to host the organization's classic white collection boxes this year. And on top of that, there are fewer people shopping in person.
We're used to our local collection boxes being overflowing, and right now they have a very sparse collection of toys in them.
Hardison says they typically distribute 18 to 19 million toys to 7 million children in the U.S.
In our country, we have about 15.5 million children living in poverty. So we barely meet half of the need out there.
And this year, Toys for Tots is already seeing an increase in demand. Hardison says they're also pushing for donations at toysfortots.org and partnering with corporations.
What we're doing right now is encouraging people to donate online, and it gives the foundation the opportunity to augment or supplement the local campaigns and kind of fill their needs, you know, wherever we can.
Typically, local Toys for Tots campaigns have big parties to distribute the toys. But that also won't be possible this year.
We're following the model of a lot of retailers, and so we're doing drop-off, you know, curbside, both curbside collection and curbside distribution.
Curbside collection has also been the model that food banks across America have been following for months during the pandemic.
Families waiting hours in their cars to get boxes of fruits and vegetables.
In Atlanta, thousands lining up in their cars for food, some waiting up to 18 hours.
Food bank organizers say these long lines won't disappear anytime soon.
I never did think that would ever happen, and I never think it would be this hard.
Feeding America Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer Katie Fitzgerald says they estimate 50 million Americans are considered food insecure just this year.
We've seen demand on average across the 200 Feeding America food banks sit pretty steadily at about a 60% increase in need in the number of people who are showing up for charitable food assistance as compared to pre-pandemic levels.
And food banks are entering the worst months in terms of food insecurity.
That's because people make economic trade-offs. They're going to have to pay to heat their home, medications. They're going to skimp on their food budget before they cut those kinds of things because that's what they need also to survive.
Fitzgerald stresses those who find themselves in need of food should not feel shame. Life happens, especially in 2020.
We know what the whole country has witnessed, which is for reasons beyond our control in our lives, bad things happen that disrupt our ability to pay our bills and feed our families. A health crisis, a lost job, and it's not a reflection on your worthiness as a human being. This is why we're here.
Fitzgerald says Feeding America's network of 200 food banks have risen to the occasion so far, but asks anyone in a position to donate to go to feedingamerica.org. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Stephanie Pawlowski, ABC News, New York.
Every morning at 9:30 Eastern Time, the bell rings on the New York Stock Exchange. It's the largest stock and securities exchange in the world, representing 2,800 companies worth about $30 trillion. The much smaller NASDAQ lists about 3,300 companies with a combined worth of around $6 billion. But NASDAQ made news this week by proposing that all of the companies listed on its exchange have at least one member of the board who identifies as a woman, and at least one who identifies as an underrepresented minority or who identifies as LGBTQ. If they don't, they'd have to publicly explain why not, or they would be delisted eventually. As of today, only about 25% of the companies currently trading on the NASDAQ can meet that requirement. NASDAQ CEO Adena Friedman tells the New York Times even this isn't an optimal composition of a board, but it is a minimum level of diversity that they think every board should have. Not everybody agrees. The conservative legal group Judicial Watch recently sued the state of California for requesting similar diversity and calls NASDAQ's proposal an Alice in Wonderland approach. The Wall Street Journal opinion page asks how you'd even find out how someone was a member of a certain underrepresented group without breaking well-established privacy laws by asking them. But some are already moving in this direction. Goldman Sachs has implemented a new policy requiring companies it helps have at least one diverse board member. They're hoping to up that to two by 2021. And California, as we mentioned, instituting a diversity quota for public companies that are headquartered in the state. What happens next is that the Securities and Exchange Commission will read over NASDAQ's proposal, then take public comments. After that, it will decide what the next steps should be. And finally, a very nice payday for this woman.
And I saw my reflection in snow-covered hills till the landslide
for selling a majority stake in her publishing catalog. Stevie Nicks has sold an 80% interest in the copyright to songs that she's written to music publisher Primary Wave. Edge of 17, Landslide, Rihanna, they're all included. It coincides with Fleetwood Mac's Dreams making the Billboard Hot 100 in October, more than 40 years after it was originally a hit, thanks to a skateboard riding, cranberry juice chugging man on TikTok. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcasts.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.